Hello and happy Wednesday. I'm Laura Sanders and you're listening to the True Travel Podcast. You may remember that it was Earth Day a couple of weeks ago, and quite fittingly, I caught up with sustainable travel journalist Richard Hammond that day. He joins me to share his simple tips for travelling more sustainably, as well as telling us about some of his own adventures. During the episode, we'll be discussing his new book, The Green Traveller, too, which has lots of useful ideas for creating less impact on the planet during your travels. And if you think that travelling sustainably means spending more money or going to a far-flung place to plant trees, well, you're wrong. Richard explains how any holiday can be done in a less impactful way, from what you decide to pack to choosing accommodation with the right eco-credentials. I hope you enjoy it, and as always, there's more from the podcast on social media. While you're here, it would be great if you could leave behind a quick review too, as it helps others to discover the podcast. Richard, it's so lovely to meet you. Thanks for coming on. And how fitting that I've got you on to talk about sustainable travel on Earth Day. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Yeah, it's been really encouraging to see just how much coverage there's been this year on Earth Day.
It really has, hasn't it? And I think coming out of this pandemic, I've said it time and time again, you know, sustainable travel and build back better are the real buzzwords, aren't they? But people really do care about it now. And as consumers of travel, people just want to know how they can best, you know, protect the planet as they travel, which is what you're going to sort of help us do during this episode, which is great. But before we get on to your latest book, The Green Traveller, just tell me a bit about yourself. You know, how did you first get into travelling and then getting to sustainable travel?
Well, it was, you know, I was quite fortunate. I had a very enthusiastic biology teacher at school who took us on a, you know, our Duke of Edinburgh's field trip to Iceland.
Wow.
You can imagine, you know, age 16, I think I was. But that kind of opened my eyes up. And then after I, you know, after I left school and I did a Rally International expedition to Mauritius, and a lot of the work we did there, Mauritius and Rodriguez, it's an island just off Mauritius to the east in the Indian Ocean. And a lot of work we did there was looking at doing some work for an ecotourism management plan. And, you know, I sort of got a first taste there of how effective it could be, actually, if you manage tourism properly for the good of people, but also good of the local wildlife, the local bird population, and nature as well. And then I got into publishing, and what was really interested in the kind of communication of natural history and travel, and worked for a publisher for several years. And then, you know, then started writing about it, and was fortunate to eventually get a column in The Guardian newspaper, which is monthly, then it went weekly, and then took off from there, really. I said to my blog, greentraveller.co.uk, back in 2006, can you believe?
That's fantastic. That was sort of the heyday for blogs, wasn't it, back in the early 2000s?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
You're lucky to have got in there. It's all, you know, YouTubing now, isn't it? But that's great. And DOV in Iceland, my DOV expedition was in Wales. How on earth did you manage to swing Iceland for your DOV expedition?
Well, yes, I mean, I think other years they'd gone to the Peak District. I went to school in Nottingham, just a Nottinghamshire Derbyshire border, and that's where they used to go. But anyway, I say we had this very enthusiastic teacher who took us all off, and it was incredible, you know, especially back then. It was many years ago now, really, and we just had an incredible time. I think it was actually 2.5-3 weeks that we went there for. And, you know, Iceland had these epic landscapes where you look at the horizon and you think, oh gosh, hopefully we're going to make it there by the end of today. And in fact, we didn't make it there for 3 days. You know, it's just so big and large, and the skies are huge. And, you know, so instead of it being one chocolate bar away, it was probably six.
I've just returned from Iceland myself, actually. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's such a vast, diverse landscape, and the weather as well. You know, you can drive into a snowstorm and it's -3, and 20 minutes on you're in bright sunshine, and it's just the epitome of, you know, all natural wonders, isn't it?
Yeah, so don't they have a saying there, if you don't like the weather, wait a minute.
Yeah exactly. Yeah, I feel like that in the UK sometimes.
Yes, yeah, especially in April this time of year. Yeah,
it's madness, isn't it? So ultimately, Richard, why should we travel more sustainably? You know, most people, they only go on holiday once or twice a year. They take a quick plane to get there. Usually it's somewhere in Europe. Why do we need to travel more sustainably? Why is it important?
So two reasons why we need to travel more sustainably. One is climate change, and the other is the nature emergency that we're living in. And the two sort of overlap somewhat. And it's very easy to kind of skip by the nature emergency, I think, because, you know, there's been so much publicity about what's going on with climate change, rightly so. But at the same time, we're seeing massive numbers of species going extinct or getting very close to extinction. And I'm not just talking about polar bears, you know, at the edge of the earth and the extremities, or about rainforests, you know, in the tropics. And they are a problem, absolutely. But it's right here at home. You know, our hedgerows are disappearing. The biodiversity is down. It's something like 15% of our bird species in the UK are at risk of extinction. And so it's we call it an emergency because it really is. And we have to figure out ways of dealing with it. And that's, you know, in our everyday lives. And that includes going what we do when we're having a break from our everyday lives and going away on holiday. And that's why it's so important. And to understand that, yeah, we have a responsibility when we leave our everyday lives to still somehow deal with this, these two twin emergencies.
Absolutely. Thank you, Richard. So let's move on to a few tips then, because I think as well, the common misconception, or, you know, rightfully so, the common belief is that sustainable travel is often more expensive. Let's take train travel, for example. Train prices in the UK are ridiculous. And then you've got flights going for 50 quid to Venice or something. You know, there is this common belief that traveling more sustainably, traveling greener, traveling slower is just unachievable for a lot of people. So what would you say to that? How can people, you know, make it affordable for themselves as well to travel a little bit greener?
Well, I'd say, to take those examples, I'll just break them down. So, you know, train travel in the UK is ridiculously expensive. You know, it is. At the busy times at commuter hour, you know, and a lot of people's experience of traveling on the train is when they're going to work, when it's busy, you know, it's incredibly expensive, you know, unless you've got a kind of, you know, rail card for the commuter, you know, year round season ticket, you know, and often the experience of it isn't great because, you know, it's so busy and overcrowded, and sometimes the trains are late because it's so busy and the whole network's, you know, overflowing. So, when you start looking at, you know, traveling off peak, it is a totally different experience. And there are things like, you know, traveling at the weekend, you can get a weekend upgrade to first class. It's, I know it sounds very kind of like, why would you, you know, trying to save money, but it's so much more pleasurable, you know, having a bit more space, you know, read the paper, you know, do all those things, you know, without having lots of sort of, you know, people going to watch sport on a Saturday afternoon, jumping up and down in your carriage. But the, you know, there are ways of making train travel cheaper for yourself. You know, for instance, split ticketing, you know, you don't always have to, if you're getting a ticket from A to B, there are ways to go, you know, you can break your journey and buy, in terms of the tickets, buying from A to halfway to B, and then from halfway to B to B. So you buy in effect two tickets, but they're much cheaper, you know, they can be much cheaper than buying just the ticket all the way. Now, there are websites that help you do that, but also, you know, the train line, National Rail, they all try and, you know, they're encouraging people to look at this now, because you can, it's just the way the system's built. But there are ways you can really make a big saving on that. And also don't forget, there are lots of rail cards, for families, for instance, for couples traveling, for off-peak time, for you know, students. There are, you know, it's worth really looking into what you can do when you're traveling by train, just see what tickets there are available at the cheap price. Don't automatically just go to, you know, the rail booking sites, put in the destinations and book it. There may well be savings that you can make. And then the second thing, you mentioned Venice. Yeah, sure. I mean, flying to Venice, you know, it's, you know, it can seem to be much cheaper to fly, but don't forget, especially if you're traveling with luggage, you know, you have to pay to get out to the airport, and at the other side, you have to probably transfer from wherever the airport is out of town, often into Venice, and then, or, you know, in other cities. But also you have to pay for putting your luggage in hold. Now that £50 ticket all of a sudden becomes 130, 140, you know, if you're putting 20, you know, 4 kilos into hold, or 22, or whatever it is. So it's not auto, it's very enticing to see all these offers that there are for low cost airlines. But, you know, when you travel by train, you don't have, there aren't the restrictions on that. And also the great thing of traveling by train, you know, it's part of the journey. It's so relaxing. You get to the train station, you're on the train already, especially things like Eurostar going across to Europe. It's so pleasurable. It's so nice looking out of the window. You go into the Channel Tunnel, then you emerge into the French countryside, and you whiz across France, and, you know, having a lovely meal in the buffet carriage or at your table, looking out the countryside. You know, you're not strapped in at 30,000 feet. And all of that entails, you know, and all the announcements that you get and all the hassle that can go with waiting for baggage reclaim and all those things. So, yeah, I mean, you know, absolutely, you know, flying can sometimes be cheaper, especially if you're a single person traveling on their own without any luggage. But don't automatically assume that.
Some great advice there, Richard. In fact, I think you'll talk about split save, aren't you, on trains? I've done that myself, commuting to London for work. So, yeah, I can save myself. It is a good way to save. You've come very nicely there onto train travel in Europe and, of course, using train as a way to see the world and to take in what you are passing, not just flying over. Just tell me about some of your train journeys. What have been some of your most memorable ones and why?
Well, one of my favourite journeys, and I've done it several times, is to take the train down to Morocco. You think, gosh, Morocco, really? And absolutely, it's possible. It's such an enjoyable journey. And, you know, often when you fly to somewhere like that, you know, Morocco is one of the closest places that's incredibly different, you know, culturally, you know, temperature-wise, everything. There's so many different things and the smells and everything. You really come alive when you're there. But if you fly, all of a sudden, you know, you leave Stansted and you arrive in Marrakesh, and it's a world apart. And it takes you a few days for your head to sort of catch up with all of that difference in culture. If you take the train, you go through France, you head down to Madrid or Barcelona, and then the train, and then through Spain to southern Spain. And you see how the countryside morphs into the Moorish culture as you go. And when you get to southern Spain, you know, I have done it several times. I'd then stay overnight, have a lovely tapas and a nice little French tapas, Spanish tapas bar, stay overnight. And then you catch the morning ferry with all the, you know, Moroccan travelers or workers who are working in southern Spain, who'd been there for a week's sail for the night before. And you feel like you're traveling with them. And you cross the Strait of Gibraltar and you see Gibraltar on your left-hand side, the big rock of Gibraltar as you pass it. And there, the African continent is ahead of you. And you arrive by boat. It's such a special way to get to anywhere, I think, by ship or by boat or yacht. But when you get off there, you know, you're at Tangier, you get all the taxi drivers, as they do everywhere, and they come rushing over wanting your business. But it's not such a kind of an assault on your senses because you've already assimilated through this journey. And it's such a special way of traveling. And, you know, I've done it different ways. You know, I've taken the train and taken and I went to a conference once where we all were shipped off on the plane to get to the conference, and my goodness, the difference in traveling overland was a totally different experience. It was like, you know, I was on a holiday. The journey started the moment I boarded Eurostar, not 2 days into the arrival at Marrakesh airport when I was still sort of bewildered about where I was exactly.
It's a really interesting point you've made. And obviously I've spoken to other people who have done train travel on this podcast and they've all said the same thing. And of course, the other advantage is not having the jet lag as well, particularly if you're traveling quite a while away. I mean, not so much with Europe, but further afield. And I think you're right there in saying that you almost do sort of go on a journey of adapting to the country you're going to, because you see, as you said, Richard, the land change as you make your way through. And this is something I noticed when I did a tour through Southeast Asia, so Vietnam, Cambodia and Thailand a few years ago. And a lot of the ways of traveling around wasn't flying from point to point, it was traveling down through the country, and you'd noticed how the food changes as you move through the regions and the languages slightly change. You know, it's not such an extreme change, it's like a gradual process. And I think that's what you're talking about there when you mentioned you know making your way down on the train and seeing that change gradually.
Yes, I mean, I describe it in the book actually as a long slow teleport.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it actually.
You can have that as much, you know, going to Morocco or like you were doing in Southeast Asia, as you can even taking the train in the UK, you know, taking the sleeper to Penzance or taking the sleeper up to the Scottish Highlands is the same. You know, you leave the urban grit and grind of, you know, of London, and you wake up, you know, in the beautiful Highlands of Scotland. And it does feel like, wow, that's a slow teleport. You know, especially when you do it in the winter and you can leave London behind and it's a bit grisly and dark and cold, and you wake up in Scotland. And I remember once doing it, I think got to Aviemore, pulled the curtains open for my sleeper Couchette, and it was all snow outside.
Oh, it sounds magical. I must take the Caledonian sleeper. There have been a couple of people that told me now how lovely it is, the experience on board as well as what you see.
Oh well, I really recommend there's a request stop you can do at Karor Station. I think it was featured in Train Spotting all those years ago, or maybe it was at The Young Ones. I think it was a Train Spotting, but they all, you can get off this request stop and you can walk, you get off at the station and then you walk for just a few minutes, literally a couple of minutes, and you look, try and look back at the station, and you can't see it because it's sort of hidden sort of around a lip of land. And you look around and you're on Rannoch Moor and there's nothing but beautiful Munros mountains, Scottish mountains, and the scenery. And you come to, about less than a mile, you come to this loch called Loch Ossian. And there's a youth hostel there you can stay. It's totally off grid. And it's just a fantastic place to spend a few days. And now at the Caror station, there's a really fabulous restaurant. So it's like, you have the best of both worlds. You can have a great foodie experience, but also being in the middle of true wilderness, really.
That sounds fantastic. I'll certainly remember that when I eventually take the Caledonian Sleeper. It sounds fantastic. So, we've spoken a lot about modes of transport and avoiding, carbon emitting planes to get to places, but there are other aspects of traveling more green, aren't there? You've got the
absolutely hotels. I'm really pleased you've raised this, because I think certainly a few years ago, I think a lot of people, when they looked at sustainable travel, it was about the flying issue, which is a thorny issue, because so many people don't necessarily live near London to get Eurostar, or they live in regional cities where regional airports point to point. There's and because of the low cost, no frills airlines, it looks attractive. But this flying issue has sort of dominated somewhat. But no, I think now being a green traveller is not about necessarily a one off gesture, not flying this year, whatever it is. It's about a mindset change, and it's about the attitude we have to all aspects of how we travel. And that applies just as much to how we pack our luggage as it is to the mode of transport we take to get to the destination, as it is about the hotel that we choose to stay in and the activities that we go on while we're there. And I think, things like packing your luggage is, the effect you can have by putting in reusable bottles, for instance, instead of buying plastic bottles when you travel, especially if you're going to, non-industrialized countries where they may not have fantastic recycling facilities, then, you can make a big difference. And, we've all seen these images of plastic buildup in the oceans and things. And that's a really simple thing you can do that can make a really big difference. And also, choosing hotels, choosing more environmentally friendly hotels, is a really important as well, because they have quite a large footprint. When you think about how many people stay in hotels, not just your one stay that one or two nights, people are in that hotel every day of the year. And there has been a concerted effort in recent years of the hospitality hotel industry going greener. And there are some fantastic certification schemes now that certify hotel businesses to make sure, not only make sure and sort of assess them, but also advise them on how they can be greener. But my advice on that would be that just to make sure, if you are looking for these certification schemes, to check that they've been accredited by an independent third party authority, because you just don't know about places unless you visited them. And so I'd always really go with a certified scheme where they actually sent someone out to visit the place, and that whole system has been accredited by the third party system.
Yeah, some really great points there. So it can be as simple as you say, taking reusable bottles with you and perhaps a reusable water bottle, to then doing a little bit of research around the place as well. But the thing is, there's a lot of confusing information out there, and you touched upon, certification schemes and eco labels. And of course, there's the whole issue around flight carbon offsetting as well, which is a different issue entirely. But, what are your tips for your average traveller who wants to book a holiday? Yes, would like to ease the guilt, but they're not going to put into researching and making sure that the hotel they're booking is green. What are your top tips for making that a simple process?
I'd say just think of three things. So how you pack your luggage. Is there anything you can do with that luggage that you don't necessarily have to take, or you can reuse it? There are great things. You're taking reusable bottles are great examples of that. Try not to take plastic. Take the packaging off before you travel. Things like spare things. Just make sure you unwrap all of that. So that's packing luggage. And also, by the way, the lighter your luggage, the less you have to pay when you put it in hold, for instance. And also, if you're then hiring an electric car when you're abroad, you don't really want heavier suitcases, means you have to keep recharging. So, the lighter you travel, the more efficient it is. So that's number one, packing your luggage. Then two is, getting out there. How are you going to get out there? Are there ways you can do that are greener? Now, obviously, taking the train or a coach, can be up to 10 times better in terms of carbon emissions than flying. You know, it's that difference. It's a huge step difference between most overland transport and planes. But having said that, if you are going to fly, if you're going really long haul and you don't have the time to go in a cargo ship or sail there or go even on a really long, week-long overland train journey, then look at places like Skyscanner has a greener choices label now on the flights. So when you're looking at flights to book, you can see which flights are greener. They've calculated, they've worked with various industry bodies to understand which flights emit less per average carbon dioxide. So that's really useful. And that can make a quite significant difference. You know, a lot of the difference between aircraft and airlines can be quite significant in what they're doing to make the journey by plane greener. You know, it's hard, given the emissions that there are by planes, it's hard to frame them as green, but you can certainly reduce your emissions by choosing, a greener choice for your route. And then the third thing I'd say is really try and look for those accommodations that are doing more than the average. And I think, you know, now we've seen big differences now at booking.com, Google now show up, they flag up in their search results hotels that have been eco-certified. So that's a great start. But also don't always look, sometimes, you know, when you choose travel, you don't always have to look for just one thing. When we choose where we're going to go away, we look at review sites, we hear what our friends say, we look at newspaper articles, you know, there's a whole range of signals that we take. It's the same, we're trying to choose a green hotel. I mean, certification can be good, but also quite a lot of places, certification schemes require the hotels to pay for their certification, and not all hotels want to do that. So you can miss out on some really good, great green places to stay that haven't gone down the certification route. So do have a look on websites, the hotel websites themselves, and see what they're saying that they do in terms of sustainability. And your advice on that would be generally, if it's sort of squirreled away in one section of the website, sustainability, then, you know, that sort of flags up slight concern. What you want to see is that it's embedded throughout all aspects of what they do. So when they talk about the food, they talk about, the local procurement, they mention businesses, local businesses that they procure the food from. And when they talk about how to get there, they talk about how you can get there by train. And what you can do when you're there, they talk about low carbon transport like cycle hire and things. So it has to be sort of throughout the whole business DNA, if you like. And so that would, there would be my three things. And, one of the conclusions I came to in researching the book was that it's much easier now to choose all aspects of the holiday to go make a greener choice, whether you're in how you're packing luggage, how you're trying to travel, and what hotels you're looking for. There are many sustainable choices out there now.
Brilliant. And of course, all of these tips and advice are in your book, The Green Traveller, and of course on your website as well. So people can go and look there. But really interesting to hear that, and good news to hear that it is becoming easier for people as well to make those choices.
You know, I'm a great believer in the power of travel and how good travel can be for cultural understanding, and also understanding your own culture. You know, you understand that a lot more when you travel. And, you know, I've traveled a lot and would encourage people to travel. So, especially younger people who, you know, setting off and want to see the world. I think that's really important that they continue to do so. But I think it's equally important that they understand just the effect of what their traveling is having. And, you know, we do include a section in the book on volunteering and positive impact holidays in far-flung places. You know, these kind of places, you probably, you know, unless you've got a lot of time, you probably would have to fly to get to them. But, you know, we encourage going on one of these volunteering schemes, but staying for 3 months. And then the effect of your flight is really put to good use in terms of what it does, whether you're working on biodiversity conservation projects or on local humanitarian efforts. You know, they can make a real difference if you spend a decent quality amount of time in these places.
Yes, it's been coined voluntourism, hasn't it? Where you and I had a friend that did it when we went to Thailand. You know, you stay and you contribute toward a conservation project, which of course can be a really immersive experience as well. It can be a really positive experience. You know, you get to know the locals and really immerse yourself in that community. So that can be a really good way of traveling in general. It can be really fun and enjoyable.
Absolutely. There's a brilliant, several brilliant initiatives going on there. Just to say, I mean, places like Village Ways, and then the also in India, the Himalayan Expedition, Global Himalayan Expeditions do fantastic work bringing light to remote villages. and making a huge difference there too. You know, imagine what light does in terms of being able to, you know, in terms of health and safety, and also just being able to read books and things like that. So it's making a huge difference. And also there's a great company called Orbis Expeditions, which does lots of great work in places like Malawi. Really good community-based work where, you know, you go on a trip or an expedition with them and you know that you'll be really, you know, genuinely making a difference to the place that you visit.
Fantastic. Thanks for those tips. So hotels with natural swimming pools, what's wrong with chlorine?
Oh dear. Yes. Well, there are all sorts of reports about, you know, the effects of when you break down chlorine. I won't go into detail of that, but you know, the main thing for me is, you know, a natural swimming pool is just so lovely swimming in it. The water is just so clear and gorgeous. And, you know, you've got wildlife all around you. It's so nice jumping into these pools and you look up and you do see butterflies and dragonflies. I mean, it's a cliche, but you do see them flitting around you. And, you know, it feels really natural just jumping in a pool like that and having a swim. I'm a great believer in hotels and natural pools. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, you see lots of public areas in places like Austria and Germany. They're called natural swimming areas. And really, it's the same kind of system. You know, you're using natural plants to help break down all the nasties in there, or just basically prevent growth of things like algae on a big scale. And so what, you know, people are trying to do it on a small scale for swimming pools and hotels are just trying to do that in a very smaller level. And yeah, I mean, I've just seen some absolutely wonderful places in, you know, in lovely places like Tuscany and the south of France. But also, you know, one of the largest natural pools is in a place up in Yorkshire, fantastic, you know, activity centre. And there's a glamp site in Norfolk that's got a natural pool, and quite a few sort of spa places now are introducing them. Because it kind of makes sense, really. You know, if you had all your, spend all this money on having a luxury spa treatment, and then at the end you jump into a pool full of chemicals, it's not the best.
I suppose it does make sense, really, doesn't it? I mean, I've just visited, you know, the natural pools of natural pools in Iceland, which of course is the Blue Lagoon.
Oh yes,
which is wonderful, and you know, I felt like, you know, the whatever natural chemicals are in there were killing whatever, you know, you've got going on in there. So yeah, it's just interesting when I came across that chapter on hotels with natural pools, I just thought I'd ask you about it. So, you know, in this book, you've mentioned all sorts of interesting ideas for traveling more sustainably here and abroad. You've mentioned tree houses, glamping sites, of course, the hotels with no pools, all sorts. So what are some of the highlighted trips? What are some of the trips you'd like to draw attention to from this book?
I love the kind of, when you look at something like a standard holiday and you think, well, how can I make a standard holiday greener? So, you know, things like the natural swimming pool thing is great because, you know, you're thinking, well, just go to, you know, an old villa or self-catering apartment that has a pool. But actually the pool is a natural pool, and that's great. But I also love the things that you don't necessarily hear about because they're not aligned to the travel industry as such. So things like, you know, former railway lines that are being converted into cycling and walkways, they're called greenways, and you find them all over Europe as well as in the UK. I mean, there's something like 400 in the UK. And they're just fantastic because they're old, you know, former railway lines. So there are no cars on them. And they've been converted. And often organizations like SusTrans, you know, the transport, sustainable transport charity, maintains them with the help of volunteers. And they're just really lovely places to go cycling. And often because they're on railway tracks, they're sort of beginning and end near areas where there used to be train stations or cities. So you can actually go from a great place to a great place, you know, for a day, you know, or even for a couple of hours. I mean, where I live in Somerset, there are lots, you know, around because we've got the canals and we've got the rivers here. And also, you know, it's interesting because you've got old railways and roads. You kind of see how transport has evolved over the last 200 years. But there are lots of ways, you know, you can there's a two tunnel system to Bristol. You know, it's fantastic between Bath and Bristol. You can cycle all the way on an off-road, you know, lane. And I think things like this greenways, people get it because they sometimes think, oh, sustainable travel is about, you know, going on some far-flung conservation holiday, or it's about, you know, some hedge laying weekend or something, or being very sort of earnest in volunteering. And it isn't that at all. It's about, you know, even about day trips that can be just going out, you know, with the kids, with the family, or with some friends, cycling for a few hours. And I think that's the heartbeat of sustainability, really, is these things that you can do, you know, with friends, enjoy yourself, that don't cost $1 million. You know, your very first question was, well, is it more expensive? Well, no, I mean, going cycling is free. And on these greenways, no one charges you to go on them. You know, for instance, something like the Tarka Trail down in Cornwall is a fantastic route. You know, where you can get, you know, head across, and there's some lovely cafes en route. Makes a brilliant day or a weekend out.
Absolutely, yes. And of course, going off grid as well, trying these off grid cabins, which I had the pleasure of doing late last year for a press trip. Actually, I stayed in a cabin where you locked your phone in a box, you had no electricity, you just had a little wood burning fire and your stove, and that was that. And that actually can be a really quirky, different experience, which, you know, I've told people about time and time again. They've gone, what, you locked your phone away, you did this? And quite often these different types of travel, these different ways of traveling, be it a bike ride or be it an off-grid cabin, whatever it is, can lead to more interesting stories and more interesting adventures, I find.
Yes, exactly. And some of the best travel experiences are things that happen spontaneously, aren't they? They're not the things that are planned. And
absolutely.
You know, perhaps when you've got put your phone away and you're a bit more open to a change of plan, dare I say it, or something not going quite according to plan. And that can then manifest itself in some amazing experience. I mean, one of my favorite trips I've literally ever done, which is sort of least impactful as well, was kayaking in the Summer Isles off the west coast of Scotland. And the company I mentioned earlier, Wilderness Scotland, they pick you up from train stations and they take you off kayaking, and you know, you're paddling and you're wild camping and you put your phone away and you don't think about getting the phone out. I mean, maybe you do for photographs, but, you know, certainly not to look or to record, you know, to kind of share what you're doing. You just enjoy the moment. And I think it was a 5-day trip, and it was amazing the effect it has on you after a week, you know, paddling and camping and swimming and sleeping out under the stars. You know, and I think they've since carbon labeled that trip, and they label it as 75 kilograms, which is, you know, over those 5-6 days is, you know, is less than, I think, less than driving your car for 25 miles a day. Yeah. So it's
fantastic. That sounds great. And yeah, you're totally right. I mean, I did it for 2-3 days and already felt, you know, great for not being hooked to my phone the whole time. So yeah, definitely get out there and put your phone away and enjoy what's around you. As cliche as that sounds, it's true.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, one of the things, green travel, green's the color of the outdoors. It's the color of trees and vegetation and organic, you know, life. And it's, you know, that's really the heart of it. You know, I think if there's one thing, I think, you know, we talk about certification schemes and we talk about the science of, you know, sometimes you get a bit sort of lost in all of that and confused by it or bewildered by it. But really, the core of sustainability is the sort of heartfelt nature of it. And you can always tell a place, you know, if you're unsure about whether a place is properly green or not, you know, you can tell by this when you meet the owners and see, you know, how they describe things and what they do and how they, you know, what energy they have about what they're doing. And for me, that's, you know, you don't really know unless you visit a place, meet the owners and see it. And then you get a sense of, you know, how heartfelt is their commitment.
Absolutely. And it's about how you impact the community as well, isn't it? This isn't just about planet, it's about people as well, and protecting people in these tourism destinations. I mean, I've just seen today that in June, people visiting Venice are going to have to pay a fee to visit Venice, which is good news. Because, you know, you have these big cruise ships pulling in. People don't spend any money there because they've got their meals booked on the cruise ship. So they go in, they wreck the place, and then they sail away. So it's, you know, taking into consideration the people as well as the environment, it's all good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you have to think, you know, we're visiting their homes, and you know, what is it like when people visit your home? You know, I often think, you know, we get often people stay in package hotels, and you know, the owners of that hotel have bought the beach. You know, how would it be if we were walking along the beach at Brighton and all of a sudden we couldn't walk across a bit because, you know, country overseas owned that bit, or a company from a company overseas owned that bit of beach?
Madness, isn't it?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, so to round off, Richard, what have you got coming up next? Any more exciting projects, travels?
Well, yes, I'm actually doing a really interesting piece of work. Actually, I do a lot of filming now these days, because filming is a really good way of conveying sustainability. Yeah, and we're doing some really interesting work looking at a series of ecotourism projects in the Mediterranean, in protected landscapes, protected areas in the Mediterranean. So in Spain and Croatia, Albania, Italy, you know, so Greece, you know, and there's such a variety of experiences there. And a lot of it is about connecting with local producers. So there's a big foodie element to it. There's also, you know, low impact activities. So that's a really great project. And so I'm going over there to film that. I've already filmed a bit of that. I'm going over again in the summer to film some more of that. And also looking forward to going to Greece. I've been going to Greece sort of in the autumn time, the last sort of 7 or 8 years, apart from during the pandemic, and going back there again. And, you know, we do these things called green travelers guides to destinations, where we sort of write about them and photograph and film them.
That's great.
Community videos. And we often go to places slightly off the beaten track, you know, rather than the classic places that everyone's heard of. So it's always interesting, and yeah, the people are so welcoming there. It's always a treat to go.
Oh yeah, well, I'll look out for that. That sounds really interesting, because of course a couple of the Greek islands are so popular, aren't they? And people forget that there are so many Greek islands you can visit and probably get a better experience as well if you go off the beaten path a bit. So I'm sure.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And you know, Greece is often thought of as a sort of beach destination. I mean, it's an incredible mountainous country. Yeah, and often where we go, we end up sort of, you know, going up mountains. I mean, you know, Crete, for example. Yeah, we did some work there, and we walked up a mountain that was higher than Snowdonia. I don't think it's generally that well known.
No, I never knew that.
Yeah, yeah. And the views from the top were amazing, you can imagine, because you could see just the beautiful turquoise sea from high up, and all the surrounding countryside. And then of course in the evening you go back and have some fantastic Greek food, you know, meals. It's terrific, with lovely Greek music.
Yes, it sounds idyllic. I'm very jealous. That's fantastic. Richard, it's been really great speaking to you and finding out more about what you do and your book, and hearing all of your useful tips as well.
Well, thanks very much. I love your podcast. So, and I'll be listening out for more episodes as they come out. Right.
Thank you. Thanks, Richard.